Today's date is August 22nd, 1997. The speaker is Dwayne Addison. The topic is Micah, Prophet of Simplicity.
Lord, we thank you for this beautiful place, this beautiful day. We thank you for the comforting and terrifying words of your servants, the prophets. Today, help us to hear and to feel and to live the words of your servant, Micah. Amen.
Amen.
I'm Dwayne Addison. I'm a semi-retired teacher of Bible, Christian Ethics, Native American Studies, and World Religions. I taught for 26 years at Augustana College in Sioux Falls, which brought my interest in Native American, American Indian communities. And since retirement, I've been teaching part-time at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. And as I explained earlier, that as a very young man, I was caught up here into the prophets by reading a Jewish rabbi named Abraham Heschel. And ever since, the prophets have been alive. And this Jewish rabbi opened up the Christian meaning of the prophets for me, like no other Christian source has done. And because, in part, he drove me to the text and a way of listening to the text. What do you know about Micah? Let me just sort of test here, and not to be embarrassed, but is it a familiar term or phrases or passages or anything of that?
It's not one of the more known ones.
That's right. He is truly among the minor prophets, or a little giant or a small giant, he is referred to. Seven short chapters. You can read this in easily in 10, 15 minutes. I mean, I don't recommend it because it's very concentrated coming to you. but the language, I'll note here, is very, very simple. I mean, this is not sophistication or profound ideas or all these sorts of things. I mean, this is as blunt as you can get, and it's brief.
Wasn't there a lot of repetition in Micah?
There's a lot of repetition in all the prophets. Yeah. But there is. I mean, you have these phrases, and I was explaining to the other class, obviously, as I read this text and listen to it, this guy, he doesn't give credit for it. He has been influenced by Amos. Oh, I mean, we took Amos several days ago. He has a passage here, the great peace passage, that I don't know who originated, maybe somebody else, because those Isaiah and Micah quote the same passage, but listen to it. Micah adds on something to it that is really a key to what Micah is about. Any other things?
It's a famous prophecy of Bethlehem being the Christmas of Jesus.
Yeah. Bethlehem is the source where God's sort of revelation and action will come. Not Jerusalem, but in the Bethlehem, they're both David's cities. David, where he brought the power and the pomp and the prestige and the creation of the great nation of Israel of the past, but in Bethlehem of the shepherd, David the shepherd, that the future lies. And we know that. And we'll be. But anything else? Yes?
Another well-known verse, 6:8. He has told you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God.
Yes. Perhaps, even if you don't know that, you probably know the most famous passage in all of the prophets. Perhaps as long like Isaiah's messianic passages as that one. I mean, it's on plaques, and it's on samplers, and it's on coffee cups, and everywhere. And each passage prophet will have the heart, and 6:8 is to do that, and we will climax and end our session with that, because it is so typical on the one hand of Micah, but also, and we'll talk here about the person and where it's setting in just a moment, but it really summarizes the message of the 8th century prophets. You know, those who've been around for a few days, we've looked at Amos, the sort of start of the whole show of writing prophets, and Hosea, his contemporary, and then Isaiah, the great genius and theologian, and all become Micah. All of these persons, I was going to say men, but some of these guys said Micah might be a woman. And there's some good evidence to raise some discussion on that. That all of this took place in a period of about 50 years. I mean, the great creative, there are some more, but some of the greatest creative minds of the Hebrew people all appeared about the same time. We do not know about their personal relations. We know that Micah must have borrowed and been deeply influenced by Amos. You see a counterpoint to the prophet Isaiah, and I'm going to pick that up a bit later. But they're writing in the same situation, but each has different priorities and different concerns. The same God, and each one feels that they are called by God. Let me begin with a personal story, and I never like name dropping, but for some this will be name dropping. And I was a seminary student. In my senior year, I had a guy named Kent Knudsen. Some of you may know him. He died too young. One of the great leaders of Lutheranism in America. He was teaching at the seminary then, and I was he was my advisor. And he encouraged me, and my enthusiasm, to go to Union Seminary to study under Reinhold Niebuhr. And that was my desire, too, because I think a couple of years before, I had taken a course in the prophet by a guy named John Victor Halvorsen that spoke with a Norwegian accent. And so I take, whenever I hear Jeremiah, Jeremiah speaks with a high, squeaky voice with a Norwegian accent. And I've come to the point here that whenever I read Hosea, I hear the voice of Reinhold Niebuhr, because I did not go to Union. Reinhold Niebuhr, who was probably the most influential theologian of the first half of this century in America, and probably more famous outside the church than within. He got there very ill. He had a stroke, and then he had other strokes. And so that fall, I went to study under Reinhold Niebuhr's younger brother, Richard, who was very different in style and concerns, marvelous teachers, both of them. And at Yale University, at that time especially, but they brought in the great preachers of the world on Sunday morning down at the Yale campus on that. And it was the Sunday just before the election, 1960. I said 1990 last time. I got to get that. On that, and there was Reinhold Niebuhr preaching at Yale that morning. And afternoon, we went out for political gatherings outside on the lawn and the green in New Haven downtown. But all of a sudden, stepped this man with half a body, Reinhold Niebuhr. A series of strokes. One side paralyzed. And the rafters, I think, literally rattled. Because Reinhold Niebuhr was one who was empowered and influenced by the voice of Micah. If you know Reinhold Niebuhr, in the simplest terms, he is one who has understood the corrupting influence of power and of self-influence, or self-interest, in all of life. And is able to point it out here how that affects politics and religious institutions and personal piety. And so it is that connection with Reinhold Niebuhr, who has been greatly influenced by Micah, that I hear the voice and see the contemporary application. And one of the things, voices that Niebuhr and everybody else in power politics and political science, perhaps the words of a Catholic historian named Lord Acton from England, and he has a sort of aphorism, power corrupts and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. That is, whenever you have power that is not adequately checked, there's going to be violence and destruction. And Niebuhr, taking the insights of St. Augustine and Luther and St. Paul and Kierkegaard and a bunch of others, was really sort of, I would say, a footnote on that insight and applied it very specifically around to everything that he watched. The setting. We're at the end of the 8th century before the Christian or the Common Era. Our prophet is a younger contemporary of Isaiah. A bit later, I want to sort of contrast him, although they're speaking some of the same concerns. Those of you who are in earlier sessions here, that we realize that this was the time of fear and chaos. The great nation of Assyria had arisen in the east and been around for some time, destroyed the great bulk of the people, of the Israelite people, and those that identified themselves as Israel, or the northern kingdom centered in the city of Samaria and the surrounding countryside. And all that was left but there's a few counties around Jerusalem and that great holy city, Jerusalem itself, from which Isaiah spoke. Isaiah spoke, he provided foreign policy advice, dealt with the leaders, and he sees this in the threat of Assyria and the lack of faithfulness, the lack of waiting upon God. He saw that God would never forsake Jerusalem because Jerusalem and David's line, the royal family, were a part of God's plan, and he could not imagine otherwise. At the same time, I'd say a younger contemporary, an almost unknown person, perhaps a woman, maybe not, perhaps a farmer, we're not sure, but as a rural man, he identifies in the sort of the opening passages from Moresheth, as a little village not far from Jerusalem, that he is there, that speaks from a different angle. I concluded the last time around that where Isaiah speaks from the centers of power, also with the command of Yahweh, the command of the Lord, here we have the voice, I think, of one who is the part of the people that, pardon, no children here, that have been crapped upon. He has been destroyed, or his people have been destroyed. And he is the voice on their half. I don't know what sort of audiences he gave this, and the evidence is there that he had been, and it's only a few miles away, he had been to Jerusalem and seen that powerful worship thing, and we must understand that chapter 6 passage in here as one, you know, who like Luther visited Rome when the Reformation began, when he saw all that sort of junk that was going on down there. And then you can imagine here Micah being, you know, the farm boy or farm girl that comes in and sees that there. Last night, some of you saw me, I played reluctantly Amos, and I'm glad they didn't ask me to play Micah, because my language had been much more angry. I mean, this is even angrier than Amos. Amos is the outsider that comes in and has these words commanded by God. I think the words of anger here come from experience and the power of God. Let us turn to that opening passage. Well, let me just sort of take this one. I did put it on your list because just to do that, and then we'll pick up and share chapter 3, verse 2, that section that is there. I talked about this Lord Acton thing. When I read this yesterday, I said, I got to share this in the Randall Niebuhr thing. Woe to those who devise wickedness and work evil upon their beds. When the morning dawns, they perform it, because it is in their power of their hands. They covet fields and seize them, and houses and take them away. They oppress a man in his house, a man his inheritance. Therefore, to imagine these people that have the power, probably associated with wealth, it indicates very clearly in many places, dream in their beds how to screw their neighbor, to put it gently, in terms of Micah's terms. They have the power to do it, and nobody is going to stop them, and certainly not the prophet or the priest. And they get up in the morning and they do it. That's the world in which he lives. The fear in the enemy is not Assyria or a coming great judgment that God is going to force upon the people. The problem here is right here in Hill City, over there in Jerusalem. Those that run our government, that run the temple, who run the market. Turn to chapter 3 and following. Who would like to read this long passage? And the sheet is wrong here. It must include verse 4 of 4, but it begins with 3:1. Anybody like to? Yes, please.
And I said, listen, you heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, should you not know justice? You who hate the good and love the evil, who tear the skin off my people, let and the flesh off their bones, who eat the flesh of my people, flay their skin off them, break their bones in pieces, and chop them up like a meat in a kettle, like flesh in a cauldron. Then they will cry to the Lord, but he will not answer them. He will hide his face from them at that time because they have acted wickedly. Four.
Yeah, just do it. It goes down all the way through three. This is a long passage, and if you're ready to go all the way through four.
Thus says the Lord concerning the prophets who lead my people astray, who cry peace when they have something to eat, but declare war against those who have nothing into their, who put nothing into their mouths. Therefore it shall be night to you without vision, and darkness to you without revelation. The sun shall go down upon the prophets, and the day shall be black over them. The seers shall be disgraced, and the diviners put to shame. They shall all cover their lips, but for there is no answer from God. But as for me, I am filled with power, with the Spirit of the Lord.
And we'll come back to this one, but go ahead. Yeah.
And with the Spirit of the Lord, and with justice and might, to declare to Jacob his transgression, and to Israel his sin. Hear this, you rulers of the house of Jacob, and chiefs of the house of Israel, who abhor justice and pervert all equity, who build Zion with blood and Jerusalem with wrong. Its rulers give judgment for a bribe. Its priests teach for a price. Its prophets give oracles for money. Yet they lean upon the Lord and say, surely the Lord is with us. No harm shall come upon us. Therefore, because of you, Zion shall be plowed as a field. Jerusalem shall become a heap of ruins, and the mountain of the house a wooded height. In the days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established at the highest of the mountains, and shall be raised up above the hills. People shall stream to it, and many nations shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth instruction, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between many peoples, and shall arbitrate between strong nations far away. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. But they shall all sit under their own vines and under their own fig trees, and no one shall make them afraid. For the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken.
That's it. It climaxes with that. I just want to call attention to one verse and then just ask me what you've heard or felt when you've heard these words. Back in, here, get my reading, I think it is 3:8. The call passage. I mean, this is it. I mean, you have this big vert of vision for Isaiah, but here I just want to lay that up. But as for me, I am filled with power, and that is terribly important. With the Spirit of the Lord, and with justice and might. And again, might is the parallel phrase for power. To declare to Jacob his transgression, and to Israel his sin. Jacob here is a poetic name for the people of God. And so anytime you usually hear Jacob or Isaac or Ephraim or Joseph in the prophets, it is another name for the people. And is usually an affectionate term because it is a poetic term and is almost always used in parallel with Israel that is there. So it is power that he is given to speak. And the issue to which he speaks is the abuse and the corruption of power. But now, what have you heard from chapters 3 and the beginning of chapter 4? Not good news. Maybe at 4, yeah.
Well, the land is going to be destroyed. Jerusalem is going to be destroyed.
Oh, yeah. Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. It is inconceivable for Isaiah of Jerusalem to imagine that God would ever abandon either Jerusalem or the dynasty of David. I mean, his whole messianic language is speaking about, or much of the messianic language is speaking here. I mean, it is David and David's line by which the time of peace will come. And here, and I know a few commentators do not really know this, because this comes out of the time, and probably the reason that Micah is in the collection of scriptures. because he made this remarkable and unacceptable prediction, and a long time later, it is proven true. Jerusalem will be destroyed. I don't know if you ever get any calls to be visiting preacher at the Jerusalem temple or any place like that. I kind of doubt it. Jerusalem is going down the tubes. Again, Zion, for those of you who are, that we use it in our hymns, Zion has become for Isaiah and already the place. Zion is a poetic name for the people, and is a poetic name for God's purpose upon earth. Zion is that hill in Jerusalem. It's not the Temple Mount that I didn't discover until I visited Jerusalem, but the hill upon which David's tomb is, and is now outside the walls of Old Jerusalem, one of the prominent hills. And this where, in about 1000 BC, David took this foreign territory, and the nation of Israel began, you know, they're going to be celebrating it here 3,000 years in a bit. On that hill, and so it is, along with the Temple Mount of Solomon, just nearby, it is the most sacred place, but it is the symbol of God's presence and purpose upon the earth. And that's going to be raised, no longer a wooded hill, but it will be devastated. So that prediction, here's the prediction that comes true. What else? Yes.
He exposes the corruption by saying that those who are willing to pay for it get a message of peace.
Yes.
Those who don't.
Doesn't that sound modern?
Yeah. That's what I was looking at. Those who can pay for the gospel get a church.
Yeah.
Those who can't, sometimes it's sticky.
People are paid off. Decisions are made with bribes. The prophets are silent. The prophets talk about peace. We can pick this up in Jeremiah later on. Most of the people called prophets are going on, no, things are beautiful. God's with us and God's going to protect us. What we call the prophets are the ones here, you know, their prime enemies, usually their opponents, were prophets, whom the establishment or the people regarded as prophets. And they were like Amos, as I did last night. I mean, he is a screaming lunatic on that, but the prophets here gave good news. We'll get some good news here. I mean, and the scholars debate here with the temple. Can this be, this modern angry, you know, this angry prophet here that speaks about the destruction with such passion and such feeling, give any good news? But that's another, we'll come to that.
You've got a question up there.
Oh, yes, please. There's the man.
Why is it always the rich people that are bad?
Here, you didn't see the thing. Not always. You can be poor and bad and middle class and bad. But in that society and ours, and I think it has always been, since there's been civilization, wealth is a primary form of power. And if that power is not checked, internally or externally, that power leads to corruption and deceit and to violence. And there is something Micah suggests, that wealth has the potential, not in and of itself, but has the potential for corruption, and the result of wealth is very often violence. Not that rich people are bad, but I would say I'd probably the band what being any sort of gifts or treasures here, if not sort of channeled right, are destructive.
Rich people have more time to go out looking for trouble.
They lie in their beds at night, as we quoted here.
Yeah, the poor people just are trying to survive.
Hey, that's good.
They don't have time to go out looking for worlds to conquer.
Yeah.
Isn't it just a basic nature of man is greed?
Yeah.
Greed, and the wealthy have had more success at being greedy.
I want to be careful. You know, I'd be very careful, because easily Micah can be, say, as occasion for bashing the rich, I mean, I always want to say, Micah's speaking to us here. And, you know, and so not to put it off these guys. And as we'll come here, clearly his message, more than any other prophet, is against the leaders. I mean, these are the people that run the church, basically the church, and the government, and run the marketplace in Jerusalem. I mean, that's where his anger is focused. And so we could take that and say, well, those are the bad guys. And but the issue here is, what is the nature of human nature? I mean, I think this is why Reinhold Niebuhr, who's one of the most great books of the first half of the century, called The Nature and Destiny of Man, here, really applied in modern terms the doctrine of original sin. That human beings, everyone, has within them that capacity, because of their self-interest, to be destructive to the other. And therefore, to deal with that, we must provide those arrangements in society to check that. And then justice is never achieved, according to Niebuhr. It is always proximate justice. And you receive a just, or the word here is equity. That appears several times here. A fairness in that. But what is fair today is going to crumble tomorrow. And we must always be conscious here of those forces of power. And I think, in our world, and it's surprising to read back here that wealth is greatest form of power. Well, no, let me check that right away. A great force of power. It is the power of Yahweh, of the Lord, with which Micah addresses it. And he addresses power with power. And that is Reinhold Niebuhr's phrase. Power must be met by power that is greater.
It seems to me that the gift of the prophet is to anyone who has any power at all, and we all have some, is that the prophet cuts through the isolation and the rationalization of our lifestyles, so that although we are not in touch with the people who are suffering in Rwanda, or in the lower east, up Harlem, or Lower East Side of New York, or in our own cities, we are still called by the prophet to respond to these people in pain, that to me is one of the most corrupting aspects of power. And a lot of good guys, I won't name any names, but good guys in office get surrounded by their their fans, and they hear all about the good things they're doing. And we need affirmation, absolutely, but it tends to distort our sense of truth. And we don't realize that we're not in touch with a complete reality here. And that the prophet is calling us back to a larger humanity and to a better sense of reality. And we don't like that.
In ancient times, alongside these prophets, every ruler had is surrounded by prophets. I mean, they told him when to go into battle, they gave him his advice on all sorts of matters, and so forth. And these were essentially yes men. And I call that the Oval Office Syndrome. Because we can all know certain times, and the President of the United States here, most of the time perhaps, knows less of what's going on in the country than you and I can know.
Absolutely.
Because he's surrounded people that are built in there for their jobs to tell him what he wants to know. I mean, this is what the CIA, correct, you know, it began here is one thing, but it's really here to give information here to support what was already decided. And what the CIA does is happening all over. It happens in churches. I mean, I don't want to name names, but it happens among bishops. It happens for pastors. It happens for college teachers. It happens to all of us that have power. The power of the teacher, the power of the pastor, the power of this businessman. You know, Amos is on target, but listen to these words here. It's heads. And again, that attack is upon the heads. The different translation of the New RSV, and that gives judgment for a bribe. You make your decision, you know, bribe is there. I mean, John Marty, you know, he's read this. And as priests teach for hire, priests, the religious establishment, I hired guns. And the prophets, divine or the term is different in the New Age, they're divine for money. They prophesy for buck. I mean, they're bought. The prophets are bought off on that. And this is the passage that grabs me. Yet they lean upon Yahweh, lean upon the Lord, and say, is not the Lord in the midst of us? No evil will come upon us. We are God's people. We are Minnesota nice, good Lutherans. Pick your phrase in that. We are Americans, or we are Danish, or whatever that. Nothing can happen to us. Answer, no, nothing except that Jerusalem's going to be wiped from the face of the earth. and it's there. Yes?
Of course, back in those days, too, we have to realize that the government and the church was one.
Yes, that's a very important point.
And it's different today now, at least in America. In fact, that's the thing.
We hope so.
it's not from the government. I know that.
Yeah.
A lot of our agencies are funded by the government, so
yeah,
either whole or part.
Yeah. Yeah. I am a strong advocate of the separation of church and state. That not because of James Madison said this or that, or that I think in America now the danger of the church, you know, corrupting the government, but. The power here and the money of the government is always there, and it comes in a variety of subtle ways here of the government here taking over the church and corrupting. And I think Micah speaks to this. And even though the situation has changed, ours is not one. I mean, you couldn't conceive about government because these were really one in ancient Israel and up until modern times.
How deep did the corruption go here? I mean, obviously he's foreseeing the total destruction of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
If the corruption were just pinpointed in the top government leaders or top church leaders, he probably would have been calling for the overthrow of the government.
But he, God was going to do that. I mean, he didn't activate us doing it, but God was going to do it. Yeah.
I understand what God's saying, but is God destroying Jerusalem because the situation was so corrupt, so deeply, you know, through the layers that it was absolutely hopeless.
Yeah.
Is that the historical perspective, you think?
Well, that's what I hear from Micah. I mean, and we can step back and look from this and put it in its context that, the prophet's message is always biased, as Heschel tells us. And he has this strong bias that the problem here is rooted in the corruption of our leaders. I mean, because the prophets that have been silent, they've been bought off, they've been silenced, and everybody's in this together. And remember here, this is a man speaking from the rural areas. It's probably been pushed around here by, you know, the market and the government, or the government church in Jerusalem. And there is a bias here that the problem lies there. Because where you have power, and the power that he saw was the power here of wealth and ruling, yes.
It's an interesting point that this happens over and over again. I've never quite understood it, but it seems though God uses a shotgun and a lot of innocent.
Yeah, you had this the other
innocents
day.
Innocents go with, and yeah. She's pointing out, and that happens over and over and over.
Yeah.
You know, the wonder, well, why didn't God just carve out these really evil ones and leave the innocents, the kids or whatever it was? But they suffered right along. They marched off to slavery, were slaughtered,
Stick around. We'll talk about that next. I always postpone these things. We can talk about Ezekiel, because Ezekiel raises the same question. Now, why does God cover all these innocent people? And he always, it's a simple idea for us, because the individual is responsible, individual is accountable. It is really not a clear idea to the prophets until they come to Ezekiel. It takes that individual accountability. And we've taken that for granted because we are a part of the later tradition here that speaks about this way. And that is very offensive to us. It's very offensive me to read the prophets because all the sort of people get shattered. You know, God's going to get those people in Jerusalem. And what about all these, what Amos talks about, the innocent people in Jerusalem? And, our sensibilities, informed by the prophets, and the prophet Jesus, say, oh no, I mean, the prophets are not the last word here. And I think you're right to be sensitive to that.
Another question.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little more about this passage we read a minute ago, about the power of the Spirit of God that lies on Micah? Is this a different kind of power than political power or economic power? And if it is not corrupting kind of power, why is it not? And why doesn't the church have it?
That's your court.
If you want to know the end of that, go to graduate.
He's doing research.
I mean, this isn't one of the most basic questions here, because it's so clear here for Micah that this kind of power, human power, wealth and connected greed and sort of and just sort of physical power are encountered by another kind of power. It is the Spirit of God that's come upon him. And I guess to be a Jew or a Christian, say that that nature of that power is different. But then I began reflecting upon experience, and you've done this too, that, and again, I come back to Reinhold Niebuhr. Reinhold Niebuhr says, you know, the most corrupting kind of power is spiritual power. On that. You know, he goes on to say that the greatest, you know, he's not alone on this, and it becomes obvious that the most violent forms of destruction come from people who act in the name of God. And confuse here, what they believe the power, spiritual power here, is to speak with sort of violent authority. And it gives here what are just sort of controversies for material things and jockeying position and competition and so forth, all of a sudden an ultimate preference. And so you can take the to take the economic situation of Northern Ireland, and you transpose that with sort of the spiritual sort of vehemence that is there, of people on both sides, you know, speaking in behalf of God. Or you could go to India, or you go to 1,000 places in history, in a great part of the Christian history, that people that at least claim to have spiritual power and do have power over the minds and souls of people are the most corrupting and corrupted of all.
I'm dubious about that, frankly.
Please.
How do you answer? I would like to know more. I can hardly speak with any certainty.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that what sets people off against each other in Northern Ireland is not their churches. It's their sense of ownership, their sense of ethnicity, their sense of, this was my grandfather's. And that has a larger part to play, in my opinion, and I'm willing to learn more, than, say, doctrinal differences between Catholics and Protestants. And I don't hear the spiritual leaders of the Catholic or Protestant churches saying, all right, let's go fight and kill. Many of them, at least, are working in peace efforts.
Yeah.
But it's very hard to change people's minds when they say, this is mine and you will not take it away from me. Sorry.
What do we mean by spiritual power? And that is open, because I guess I have the fundamental hope there is a different kind of power, that Christians will be talking about the Holy Spirit that is of a different quality. And just as powerful is the kinds of human power that you speak of there or that we speak of here. And that I have to live with that hope. And who is going
to share? It translates to Israel and the Palestinians. You know, if you've seen your mother, father, brother, sister slaughtered, kids see this. It's not a religious thing anymore. It's vengeance. It's really what I think is driving a lot of what happens in Ireland and in Israel. And what's the answer to that? The answer is the rapture, I guess.
Well, I hope there's something before the rapture. Let me come back to this, because I read history, and some of you are in this too, that almost always when the oppressed cast off the oppression and take charge, they are more violent
Modeling after the oppressor.
The French Revolution and the Reign of Terror. The speakers have talked about liberty, equality, and fraternity come on, and they were more vengeful and more violent than the ancient regime. Central America, I can think of some cases in here on which the oppression is cast off, and those here are now in power. The temptations of power, and one of the failures of Marxism, and this is a little discursion here, is really, as Reinhold Niebuhr suggests, as failure of any comprehensive insight into the corruptive nature of power. And so when the poor receive power, or the powerless receive power, they are just as corruptible, perhaps more, but just as corruptible as the wealthy and those with the guns and the power. And that is such a deep thing. And I don't think Micah, the limited voice here, speaks of that. And so again, Micah is not the last verse. And that reference here, the power that demeans him, I think that we have to put our own imaginations, and we have come with lots more experience, we have other prophetic voices, and I think we have to move from Micah. He has a true thing. I mean, what we haven't touched upon, I'm surprised that we picked up in the other session, we had opened that session, it sounds like a cook here at Holden Village, you know. You're skinning the people and taking off their flesh and putting them in the pot. And that is gruesome language. And if Micah is, if anything, he is blunt. But this is not to be taken literally, I'm sure. But this is what is happening. When power in Jerusalem is not corrupted, and the people are skinned alive. The people he knows in Moresheth, in the valleys and the hills that surround Jerusalem, they are being skinned alive by their people. Their power is not checked. There are other concerns here.
Yes, what's the limit here?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry, I missed that. Yeah.
Well, it seems to me that the people took the prophets kind of like some teenagers take smoking, like, well, what they're saying, maybe it's going to happen to somebody else, it's not going to happen to me.
Yeah, that's that passage I read in a moment, and, you know, we'll lean upon the Lord. Boy, that is religious language. Nothing can go wrong here. And he doesn't speak to me. I mean, that's why I have that deep feeling about the prophets, looking as they developed it. Almost always, these prophets were not accepted in their own time. I mean, their words were remembered or written down. And then maybe a generation or a century later, boy, these guys were on target. The guys they called the prophets, said, yes, they are on target. These are the great preachers. These will fill our pulpits. But what we call the prophets, almost without exception, were not honored in their own time. So what does Jesus say when he goes to Nazareth? A prophet is without honor in his own country. It is almost always the case. And that, and so we have to imagine here, if we were there, would I have done any differently? If I were one of these sort of businessmen or priests in Jerusalem, and how would I have responded to Micah if he came to town? Or wherever he preached. We don't know where he preached. We don't have an encounter there of that. And but yes.
Could you say something about the nature of the prophecy as to inspiration? I can imagine a prophet saying, "Oh, Nazareth," and then he was wrong. And another prophet saying, "Jerusalem on the hill, you shall never be destroyed," and he was wrong. And this Micah says, "Oh, Bethlehem," and then he says, "Jerusalem," and he's right. Is this divine inspiration that was to foretell this happening, or was he lucky and therefore was
recorded? My answer is yes. a prophecy thing has to essentially ring true. And I think it is seen in retrospect that, and it is an uncanny thing. I have no doubt that this was a person inspired by God. And they may be wrong in details, in part because we probably can't understand and interpret that, But because of that spirit and that might that came upon him, he was able to discern the meaning of the moments and the flow of history that is there. Somehow, I cannot explain it psychologically or even theologically, but the confidence here that God spoke through every one of these prophets that we have in our canon. And especially through Micah. I mean, I read Micah, and I reaffirm that the doctrine of inspiration on that. But how can a guy, in the limited range that he deals, be so on target? It is uncanny. We speak about poets being inspired, and I think, even in that level, Micah is inspired. But in the larger frame of the flow of history, and I would add that he now needs to be qualified by the message of Jeremiah and Ezekiel, because this is only a part of the message, and you have brought out that concern that we as Christians share. And I will be coming to those who stick around here. I don't have the session on Jesus, but the culmination of the prophetic voice we have in Jesus the prophet from Nazareth. I mean, that has really brought many of these themes together, and he is the voice by which God speaks to our needs and hearts. And so when I speak about a prophet, for me, it goes to the very heart of the Christian faith and our understanding of the triune God. Because that connection there, I don't know if that's the revelation, but, and humanly speaking, and the scholars will take that and see how it sort of developed humanly on that. That's good, but finally here, I think it is a matter of trust and faith. Not simply because of God in the book, and that history is important. But you must listen to the words. And the truth of the word here is that it rang true. And that might feel negatively when we hear it. We can imagine ourselves, and that's why I say that Micah is so modern. I said to Don, you can read this in 10 or 15 minutes. But I find it offensive. The language is offensive. And for me, it speaks here not about the leaders in Jerusalem, or not about the leaders in the Oval Office or in the, Wall Street. This is speaking about me. And the prophet almost always comes to that. If you hear the prophet, there's a voice here speaking to your heart. That's why that chapter 6-8 is really the heart and the culmination of Micah's prophecy. How are we dealing here? I want to get to that 10 minutes left. Let's take a quick read of 5 verses 2 to 6. We've alluded to it. Who would read that? Yes, please.
But you, O Bethlehem of Ephrathah, who are you of the little clans of Judah? From you shall come forth for me one who is to rule in Israel, whose origin is from of old, from ancient days. Therefore he shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor has brought forth. Then the rest of his kindred shall return to the people of Israel. And he shall stand and feed his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they shall live secure, for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth.
Through six.
Okay. And he shall be the one of peace. If the Assyrians come into our land and tread upon our soil, we will raise against them 7 shepherds and 8 installed as rulers. They shall rule the land of Assyria with the sword, and the land of Nimrod with the drawn sword. They shall rescue us from the Assyrians if they come into our land or tread within our border.
Okay, that's fine. There are all sorts of allusions here that we haven't had a chance to get into, but that uncanny thing, and scholars debate how authentic this is, and I'm persuaded, can be unpersuaded here, that this is sort of at the heart here of Micah's prophecy, that the future of God's purpose on earth is no longer in Jerusalem and the David of the pomp and power that come out of Zion. And I would take this as an allusion that the future here is still God's future, but it is the David of Bethlehem. There are 2 cities of David, in the Bible. Jerusalem, the one that he conquered and made the capital of the ancient nation of Israel. and 1000 BC, but also the young David, the shepherd, the poet, the one who had his heart close to God.
Okay.
This is considered one of the great messianic passages. In some of the earlier sessions, you know, that there are a number of allusions that are messianic here, about the messianic age, and so not only this one. And so we have these intimations about a time in which God's promise will be fulfilled. But the heart of the concern of Micah is it's not going to come as you expect, you know, through royalty or through power. It will come through that simple village, the ancient village of Bethlehem. But, I mean, that has all sorts of poetic allusions and stuff, and it's amazing sort of passage that is there. But I want to go on and make sure we deal with the heart passage on that. This is the biggie, 6 verses 6 to 8. Probably the most familiar passage in the prophets. Who is willing to read that? Yes, please.
With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, and to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God?
And especially that last verse, 6-8. What do you hear? What's going on here? What's being said then, and what do you hear for yourself?
It's not showtime.
What?
It's not showtime.
Not showtime.
We're not supposed to be doing flashy things.
Yeah.
We're supposed to be paying attention to what our job is, mm-hmm. how we treat people, how we treat those around us, how we treat those who maybe can share our resources, and
simple things.
Keep track of humility. Kind of, we talked about Bill Grace's class yesterday, maybe about mm-hmm. the hubris and we're the same stuff as the world and everyone else, and not exalted because we're Christians or for any other reason, because we're rich.
Okay, you hear that?
It's exactly the opposite of the values of the day, too, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, then and now.
You're not going to be successful if you do that.
Pardon?
You won't be successful if you do that.
God, we define success. Success is what brings you happiness. You will be.
Yeah. I read this passage, and I put it in a framework of that. There is Micah, this farmer, or this small businessman, perhaps. Maybe a woman from Morasheth, and he visits Jerusalem quite often. He's talking about the temple and the beautiful and marvelous worship that is there. Sorry about that, folks. And again, I think I mentioned, I don't know what classes I did this where I thought about it yesterday or morning, but I said I imagined Martin Luther as a young monk going down to Rome and puking. And this is what's going on. Here's where all that money from Germany is going here to build this sort of, you know, building program down in Rome on that. And then something like that. And he sees this, and somehow by the power and the Spirit of God inspires this worship, because the final message, I think, and the heart of it, I think, are intuitively after picking this up. The real issue is how we worship. Not what they're doing down in Jerusalem in the temple they call the Temple of the Lord, or the Temple of Solomon. I don't know if he says that, but he would probably refer that to Solomon's temple. But what does God require? You know that. You've had it in plaques and samplers, coffee cups. Anybody get a coffee cup with that? What does the Lord require?
Do justice.
To do justice.
Kindness.
Show kindness, walk humbly with your God. If you read your Oxford Annotated Bible, somebody had brought one in, and I've got my version here. They said, this is a neat summary of the message of the 8th century prophets. I mean, we looked at prophets all week, and we've only called it half a century. I mean, we started with Amos, and this is probably less than 50 years later that we have this, but whether it's intended or not. But I do believe that Micah is deeply influenced by Amos. I mean, the allusions are there all over the place, and the pride, the concerns on that. To do justice, that is the primary message of Amos, justice and righteousness. The love kindness, in the Hebrew, it is to show chesed, that loving kindness that Heschel says was God's thing for us and our thing for God and the other. And to walk humbly with your God. And some have said that all that great complex message of Isaiah of Jerusalem can be summed up in the word faith or faithfulness. Walking in humility and the presence of this powerful God. That's what worship is. The prophet has spoken. If you do that, you are honoring and acknowledging who the Lord is. Jesus picks this up. Are you surprised? one passage, Matthew 20:23, when he talks here about his opponents, the Pharisees, of being so religious that they tithe the herbs of their garden. I prefer to the weeds of the garden, but that is a good, better translation, herbs on there. And do not know the weightier matters of God's Torah, God's instruction. And the translations vary, but it is a direct reference. Justice and mercy and faith. What your translation 23:23, and there is a parallel passage in Luke. And I always imagine here, I mean, there's no direct textual connection in the great parable of the rich man and Lazarus. But this man has this poor man at his door, and he ignores him. He is not honored, he is not treated well. And then he dies, and his brothers, who are very devout, ask for somebody, but somebody would speak to him. And the voice of Jesus in the parable, even if somebody came back from the dead, he would not hear. Let him hear Moses and the prophets. You have all you need to know, Jesus is saying. And I agree here that Jesus is referring to Deuteronomy, and what is summarized here in Micah. He knew, as the son of Israel, as a member of the covenant community, what God requires in worship and in life is justice, mercy, and faithfulness. I put in the title today, Micah, the prophet of simplicity. His language is simple. His concerns are simple. He has only one string in his bow, almost, on there. But what God requires is utterly simple. And here we share a place with our Jewish brothers and sisters. If one thing is certain, in broad terms, it may be very difficult to carry out. I'll admit that, and Luther's done that part. What God requires are these three simple things that are one. And my Jewish friends, that God believes that you can do it. And Lutherans will quibble with that because we have a sort of different understanding of the nature of the heart. Perhaps on that we struggle in that. But so we'll grant from the Lutheran perspective that the heart is deceitful. And not only the heart of the wealthy people in Jerusalem or Washington or headquarters or the marketplace, and go beyond here that Jeremiah will talk about and Ezekiel will talk about, the heart is deceitful that is right here and not simply out there and up there. And that will sort of protect us from bashing the wealthy and the powerful, because we talk about power in a more subtle sort of sense. Time is almost up. Somebody in the last collection, hang on for just a second, the coffee will remain Somebody suggested that Michael was a woman. In fact, it is often used, not often, but it has been used as a woman's name. And I was just reading yesterday, I was sort of struck in verse 6:4, if mine is sort of handy. I want to do that and call your attention that we're now aware of all these people that want inclusive language. We do our prayers at Holden. There's always Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebecca, and all the women are sort of meshed with the men. And it did that start at Holden Village here about these feminists that were sort of here in this inclusive language nest. But what does it say in 6:4? I brought you out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of bondage. I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam.
Yay!
She and all you have to do is, you know, read the books there, and she was really the power behind these brothers. I mean, it's a sister and brother combination. So there it is. And there are allusions here that are in Isaiah, and there are here allusions here that a woman would understand it. Even if he is a man, this guy had some was in touch with the concerns of women. And I love that little phrase. And one last word, because it's not a part of the message, but have any of you had any connection with Yom Kippur? You know what Yom Kippur is. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, the High Holy Days, the complex. It's the most important event in Judaism, in the ritual year. The new year begins, you have your time of repentance, the time here, if you're a faithful Jew, you make amends within the community, and you gather here at the temple or the synagogue in most places in our time, and a part of the liturgy of Yom Kippur is from the book of Micah. At the very end, it concludes the chapter, and scholars say, well, somebody later must have added that, because this doesn't sound like Micah. Micah doesn't have that much sort of a, you know, sort of excitement, a sense of forgiveness, but we'll leave that to be open, but it ends here. And I think some of the most beautiful words of all of Scripture. Who is a God like thee, pardoning iniquity, and passing over transgression for the remnant of his inheritance? He does not retain his anger forever, because he delights in steadfast love. He will again have compassion upon us. He will tread out iniquities underfoot. Thou wilt cast all our sins into the depth of the sea. What a marvelous image. Thou wilt show faithfulness to Jacob, that is, to God's people, and steadfast love to Abraham, as thou hast shown to our fathers and for the days of old. Whether Micah at the end of the 8th century wrote that or somebody else, I think that is the fitting climax to the prophecy of Micah. Forgiveness. Thanks a lot.